From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Congress may soon have its first debate in years about the legal cornerstone of America's military actions overseas. Yesterday, the Republican-led House Appropriations Committee approved an amendment calling for the repeal of the authorization for use of military force, which Presidents Bush, Obama, and Trump have used to justify military campaigns from Iraq to Syria. The vote was a surprising victory for the amendment's sponsor, Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California, who's been a vocal opponent of the measure ever since it was introduced just 3 days after the 9/11 attacks. Representative Lee joins us now. And Congresswoman, were you surprised that your Republican colleagues voted with you on this?
You know, I was cautiously optimistic, and I'll tell you why. I have been working for many, many, many years trying to build bipartisan support for the repeal of the 2001 resolution, of course, which I was the only one who voted against because I knew that it was setting the legal foundation for perpetual war. I tried in many ways, a freestanding bill, amendments to the defense authorization bill, prior amendments to defense appropriations. And so this has been a long and uphill battle, long process and uphill battle. But clearly, members are coming to this position. And so yesterday at the Appropriations Committee, what took place was we had a debate. And we talked about why, in fact, Congress was not doing its job, and we needed to fulfill our constitutional responsibilities by repealing this resolution and debating and coming up with another authorization, a debate at least, and vote one up or down for the new wars that this country is engaged in.
But what do you think got some of your Republican colleagues on that committee to finally side with you?
Well, I've been talking with them for many years, and I think it's more what members on both sides understand this to be, and they see additional troops, for example, about to be deployed into Afghanistan. And we had the Congressional Research Service do it, an unclassified report saying that this authorization has been used at least 37 times for non-related 9/11 events, drone attacks, wireless surveillance. And so we laid out the facts. I've presented the facts, and members have looked at the facts. And I believe that Republicans and Democrats are really beginning to conclude what I did 16 years ago, that it was a blank check. And again, I think, and members who spoke talked about the fact that our young men and women deserve the Congress to at least authorize what they're doing. And at this current moment, we are not.
Well, and I just want to read people a little bit from the AUMF. It says, quote, "The president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons." And you're saying that since 2001, this is just being used for any military action in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, or anywhere else?
It was used with regard to Libya. Those 60 words have been used even for non-military actions. And it's really very dangerous because you just read it, and thank you for reading those 60 words, because it's an overly broad authorization that provides a way to justify a legal foundation to continue to use force without coming to Congress. ISIS was nowhere around 9/11. ISIS,
right,
you know, emerged after Iraq. And so when you look at what has taken place since 2001, you know, this authorization has been used everywhere in the world, and it really should be repealed. We've come one step closer to repealing it after yesterday's vote, but you know, we've got to continue to make sure that the Republican leadership plays close attention to this vote and not try to stop the will of the House and the will of the American people.
Now, the chairwoman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, Texas Republican Kay Granger, spoke out against your amendment, saying it would tie the hands of the U.S. in its fight against terrorists. What do you say to people who believe that that's the case in this new kind of war the president has to have the ability to act.
Well, it doesn't tie this administration's hands at all, because what this repeal does is once the president signs it into law, it will remain on the books for 8 months. 8 months. Congress can debate a new authorization within 8 months. The 9/11 resolution, that was written, the one that I voted against, that was written in 3 days. I was the only one who voted against it, and it has become the legal foundation for all these wars. So you cannot tell me that we can't take 8 months and come up with a rational resolution where members of Congress can represent their people, voice their opinions, and vote one up or down.
That's Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California. Congresswoman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
To the Twitter wars now. MSNBC's Morning Joe hosts Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough wrote an op-ed in today's Washington Post titled, "Donald Trump is Not Well." Responding to his tweet yesterday, he said they begged to come to Mar-a-Lago, but she was bleeding from a facelift. They wrote he begged them to come, and she didn't have a facelift. Surely TV viewers would notice that. Then today, Joe Scarborough said Trump aides once tried to blackmail him and Mika for friendlier coverage by threatening a bad National Enquirer article. The president tweeted that Scarborough called him to kill an Enquirer article. Scarborough tweeted back, "What's wrong with you? I have emails to prove it." It's been like watching a couple argue over who broke up first, but it's the president of the United States. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, joins us for a look at the news through social media. And Femi, we have to start with these tweets. Yesterday, the personal attack on a woman's face, and to some that was appalling. Lots of lawmakers getting on Twitter to ask the president to stop. Then this tweet today, it's charges of blackmail. What are people saying?
This Washington Post opinion piece by the two co-hosts of Morning Joe is peppered with one-liners. I'm almost thinking they're thinking, what will be the one-liners that people will want to tweet? They're literally lifting out bits from this op-ed and putting it on Twitter. Here's one. The 45th president is setting the poorest of standards for our children. And then Mika, the co-host of Morning Joe, actually addressing straight on the charges of plastic surgery. And she says, "I had my chin tweaked. I'm pretty transparent about what I do." That's that. Then, this is really curious, Robin, here. Exactly 24 hours to the minute, a new tweet from @RealDonaldTrump. And he has a little analysis of the show that he watched earlier on this morning. And he watched Morning Joe. This is what he says about Morning Joe. He watched the low-rated @MorningJoe for the first time in a long time. Fake news. And he called me to stop a National Enquirer article. I said no. Bad show. That, yeah. So you know definitely what the president was watching this morning.
And he was responding to this really, I mean, I wonder where this will go. You know, this Joe Scarborough claim that President Trump's aides actually wrote him and threatened a, you know, bad coverage in the National Enquirer unless the president got better coverage on the show. Well, we're probably going to hear more about that. But there's other social media news. You wanted us to know about an NRA ad that's been generating reaction online. In it, a woman talks about people in the U.S. using the media and schools to further their agenda, teaching children that their president is another Hitler, trying to convince people to protest and smash windows and burn cars. And then there's this.
The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Femi, what are people saying?
This ad has been out for a little while. It's been out for about 2 months. And as all things viral, you can never quite work out, why did this particularly go viral now? Why is everybody talking about it? And it's because of that last phrase there, the clenched fist of truth. Now, people who are not supporters of the NRA are saying it is encouraging gun owners and potential gun owners to go out and commit some kind of violence, to use their guns in a way that is retaliating. And the symbol that's being used is a clenched fist, which is a symbol that's being used under the phrase resist, which is the pushback to the Trump administration. So it's almost as if the NRA is using the icons and the language of the resistance in order to have that conversation. Of course, It is a recruitment ad. It's supposed to be controversial. The NRA ad is doing just what it intended to do.
Yeah, I just want to mention something quickly because there is another media story that was overshadowed by the MSNBC story, and it involves Greta Van Susteren, a Fox host for 14 years, hired at MSNBC just 6 months ago and tweeted out five words, "I am out at MSNBC."
And that was it. She'd been at MSNBC for 6 months. There was a lot of sympathy and empathy underneath that tweet. It reached about 15,000 people just by that one tweet. And then, of course, all the media organizations picked up on it as well. So I suppose it's a good way of spreading the bad news immediately, just saying, I'm done. I'm done with MSNBC.
It's kind of interesting because Jeremy and I were saying she would get a lot of, you know, people more to the right on MSNBC. She'd get a lot of Republicans on and maybe more diversity of voices. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks for looking at the news through social media.
I'm off to look at some presidential tweets.
This morning, a new statue of John Gilbert Wynant was unveiled in Concord, New Hampshire. Wynant was a three-term governor of New Hampshire and the U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom during World War II. But his tragic death, in many ways, has always overshadowed his life. Todd Bookman of Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio has this profile.
More than anything he accomplished, any legislation or high-profile position, John Wynant's personality remains his legacy.
Well, he was a very charming individual, apparently.
This is Dick Hesse, professor emeritus at the University of New Hampshire School of Law and a Wynant fan.
It was said that when he walked into a room, women immediately fell in love with him. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but in any event.
Maybe it was Wynant's neatly parted black hair or his thick, bushy eyebrows. Tall and thin, he earned comparisons in both demeanor and appearance to Abraham Lincoln. Wynant was born in New York City in 1889 and sent to the elite St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire for his education. Another admirer of John Wynant is Steve Shurtleff, the New Hampshire House Democratic leader. After teaching at St. Paul's for a few years, Wynant enlisted in World War I.
Yeah, he was in the Army Air Corps. He was a flyer and rose to the rank of captain.
Wynant led an observation squadron behind enemy lines. It was dangerous work.
He was decorated for his service, but very humble about what he did.
After the war, Wynant came back to Concord and in 1924 ran for governor as a progressive Republican. Hesse says his platform was focused on the working class.
And so his mission was shorter working hours, better working conditions, particularly for women, some sort of child labor regulation. These were the primary concerns.
After a few years out of office, Wynant regained the governor's seat just as the Great Depression was taking hold. His personal acts of charity would become legend, says Shurtleff.
There's a story about one time the governor coming in the middle of winter into the governor's office, and he had no top coat, and he was wet because it was snowing out. And they said, "Governor, where's your jet coat?" And he said, "Well, I saw somebody on the way in today that needed it more, and I gave it to him." That was Governor Wynant.
The next stage in Wynant's life would take place in Europe. In late 1940, London was a city under siege from relentless German bombers.
You know, it really looked bad. They were holding on by the skin of their teeth.
That's Lynn Olson, an historian who has written about Wynant. The then ambassador, Joseph Kennedy, considered England a lost cause. He wanted out. FDR would turn to John Wynant as the next ambassador. He showed the citizens of London, immediately upon his arrival, that America stood with them.
And the first thing he said when he got to England was, there's no place I'd rather be.
Mr. John G. Wynant stepped from his plane, which was an hour ahead of schedule, and a few moments later he was with the Duke of Kent, who had flown to meet him.
I haven't much to say. I am very glad to be here. There's no place I'd rather be at this time than in England.
On his way to London.
London was living on the edge, and Wynant lived on the edge with them. During the air raids, he'd walk the streets and help people out of the rubble.
And as a result, the British loved him.
That popularity helped draw Wynant into the inner circle of Prime Minister Winston Churchill. The American ambassador was in Churchill's company the night news broke of Pearl Harbor. He spent many nights with the Churchill family. Wynant, at this point, didn't have much family of his own. Again, Steve Shurtleff.
Governor Wynant, for some years, had been estranged from his own wife, and it was a very rocky relationship. He fell in love with Winston Churchill's daughter, Sarah.
Sarah Churchill was ending her own failed marriage, and the two would become pretty close. So close, in fact, that as Winans' days in England were coming to a close, he asked Sarah Churchill to marry him.
But she told the governor, no, I've got things I want to do. I just got out of a marriage. I don't want to get into another one.
In 1946, Winant came back to Concord, New Hampshire, alone. De Kesey says he was brokenhearted, his political future uncertain.
He was working on his memoirs. He was in ill health. He was a disappointed lover.
Winant, at one time a millionaire, was also deeply in debt.
It all came crashing down in November of 1947.
Steve Shurtleff recounts Winant's last moments.
Sadly, he went to his second floor bedroom and looking out at the hills that he used to walk through as a student and instructor at St. Paul's, he sadly took his own life with a 25-millimeter gun.
While English royalty marked his death and contributions in life, in the United States, in New Hampshire, the suicide was just too taboo. He was simply gone.
He disappeared.
Today, the remains of John Winant are in a small cemetery on the campus of St. Paul's School, his alma mater. That's where Mike Hirschfeld is the rector.
The beginning of his epitaph, which are words that he spoke in 1946, go like this. Doing the day's work day by day, doing a little, adding a little, broadening our bases, wanting not only for ourselves, but for others. Wonderful expression of I think of our highest hopes as a country and as a people.
That expression of service, that Lincoln-like way Winant had of connecting, there's a hint of that in the design of the new statue of him in Concord, New Hampshire. Winant is wearing a suit and tie, his overcoat draped over his arm, posed with his hat in hand. A humble man in life and in death. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Well, many Americans may be heading to the national parks for the holiday, but they'll have nothing on Micah Meyer. He's 14 months into a tour of all 417 areas of the national park system in one continuous trip. He plans to be the youngest person in the world to do that. Micah started in Washington, D.C., and he finds himself in Washington State and joins us by Skype. Hi, Micah.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it sounds like a lot of fun what you're doing. Is it after 14 months?
Fun is not the word that I would use to describe it. You know, all at once, it's the most challenging thing I've ever done with my life and the most fulfilling thing. So there are moments of fun and also moments of stress all at the same time.
What have you seen so far? I mean, you can't tell me everything, but what are some of the highlights of your trip?
Basically, I've seen the entirety of the upper Midwest, the New England, the entire Gulf Coast, and everything working my way from Texas to Washington. So, you know, it's really run the gamut, everything from crystal clear beaches in the southeast to mountain ranges above 10,000 feet in Utah. It's just really shown me what an incredibly diverse country we live in.
And the goal of what you're doing is what exactly? What are you trying to bring attention to?
Well, you know, for me, as somebody who grew up in a state where my entire concept of LGBT people was only what I saw on TV, I'm really trying to create a new type of LGBT role model that I certainly didn't see as a kid and that I haven't seen anywhere as an adult. And a lot of the reason that I'm doing this is to honor my dad, who was a Lutheran campus pastor and who passed away when I was 19. He was 58 at the time. And so it's been, for me, a personal goal to honor his life, but also to share this message that I learned, this idea that life is short and tomorrow is not guaranteed. And so as a gay Christian, it's been important to me to share both the faith that I've had in following this journey, even when it hasn't been the easiest thing to do, and trying to, once again, provide that role model that doesn't really exist.
How are you funding 3 years on the road going through all these national parks?
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest stresses of this whole project. I spent about 2 years before I launched and contacted over 800 different companies and essentially heard back the same thing from all of them. And that was, it's a really great project, a great concept, but you're not famous, so we don't care. So at that point, I took a leap of faith, essentially. And so I essentially set out on the road without the money to complete this project. And my largest source of funding is still my personal savings from working in my 20s. And then after that, it's individual donations, whether people donate on my website or most of it is from singing and speaking at churches. Every Sunday, I'm at a different church around America, kind of singing for my supper.
So they pay you to sing at the churches?
No. So I always offer to come sing and speak for free and then just share my story. And then if people want to help, if it's on their hearts to, you know, be a part of this journey, then I accept donations that way.
So of all of the places that you've been so far, have any of the national parks been disappointing to you? Because I've never been to a bad one, but you tell me.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So I heard a wonderful explanation of the national park system from a ranger in Biscayne National Park. And he essentially asked all the visitors on this boat tour to tell him their nearest national park, and then he would guess where they were from. And so somebody said, Acadia National Park. And he said, oh, you're from Portland, Maine. And they said, no, we're from Cape Cod. And he said, well, what about the Cape Cod National Seashore? And so he explained that, you know, we have these 59 capital N, capital P national parks, but there are 417, what many rangers refer to as lowercase N, lowercase P national parks. And so for me, you know, being the only person doing this journey to all 417, it's been interesting for me to see the way that a name does not always correlate to a park experience. You know, some of my favorite sites that I've been to are national monuments.
Like what?
Dinosaur National Monument is on the border of Utah and Colorado up near Wyoming and is one of the most stunning landscapes I've experienced thus far. It's got canyons, it's got rivers, it's got plateaus and snow-capped mountains. And I think a lot of people overlook it because it's not a capital N, capital P park.
That's Micah Meyer, who is trying to be the youngest person in the world to visit all 417 areas of the national park system. He's about 14 months into his trip. Micah, thanks for joining us and good luck. Have fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Micah is going into Olympic National Park, home to the banana slug. It's cute. Look it up.
Recreational marijuana goes on sale for the first time in Nevada at midnight. A quick turnaround. Voters just passed a ballot measure in November. California and Massachusetts passed similar propositions, but sales won't begin there till next year. So is Nevada going too fast? Nevada Public Radio's Rachel Christensen is in Las Vegas. Rachel, we hear this is the talk of the town.
Well, it should be an interesting weekend, to say the least. It's a big holiday weekend here, 320,000 tourists plus 2 million residents. The big question is, are they ready? Are we ready?
So many of the same restrictions are in other states. You can't just walk down a street and smoke marijuana. It will be a $600 fine. Can't smoke it while driving. But where can people in Nevada get it and where can they use it?
Well, they can walk into any dispensary.
These are medical dispensaries.
Medical dispensaries, right. Most of them do have their recreational licenses now. So they'll be able to walk into a dispensary as long as they have cash on them or 21 and have their ID.
And by the way, you said cash. It has to be cash. Cash sale.
It has to be cash. It's still a cash industry. You know, there's still issues with the banking, you know, and since it's still illegal federally, it's still a cash industry. But as far as where they can smoke it, that also is an issue because people that live here can go to their homes. But tourists, on the other hand, don't really have a place to go.
Right. You're only supposed to use it in a private home. But people are speculating that that means that edible marijuana might be more popular. You mentioned medical marijuana dispensaries can sell it, but there was a dispute over who will distribute it. Who won there?
Right. The first wrench really that was thrown into rolling this program out early was when a group of liquor distributors filed an injunction and said, hey, it was written into the law that we get first distribution rights for the first 18 months. And a judge actually ruled in their favor. And so from about 90 applicants who applied for a distribution license in the state, that cut that number down to 5.
So alcohol distributors, this was just 2 weeks ago. Do they know where to get it? Do they know how to distribute it?
They don't. From what I've heard, those details are still being ironed out. And dispensaries can now only sell the stock that they have in their store.
Well, that means while everybody's celebrating today, the stock of marijuana in Nevada could be depleted pretty soon.
Right. There have been estimates that it should last somewhere between 30 and 60 days. And that estimate is very generous.
But we understand some lawmakers there are just gleeful about the possible tax revenue windfall. This is a state that got hit hard by the recession. What's the expectation of the money that marijuana might bring in?
you know, they're expecting about $60 million to go into our general fund, you know, over the next year or so. And then over the next 2 years, $700 million might be sold in marijuana products. So, you know, they're really hoping they can figure this distribution issue out because people are ready. We have California residents coming over. And if there were ever a time where Nevada is getting to tip the old cowboy hat to California, it's now.
By the way, though, it's going to be pretty expensive with 34% tax, an ounce.
Correct.
How much would an ounce cost?
That's going to make an ounce of marijuana close to $400 in a dispensary.
Wow.
Not comparable with street prices, and that may be an issue to come.
Nevada Public Radio's Rachel Christensen in Las Vegas, ahead of the state's selling of recreational marijuana starting at midnight tonight. Rachel, thank you.
No problem.
The Senate is heading out for a 10-day July 4th recess, and it's not clear when revisions to the Republican health care bill will be ready and when the Senate will vote on it. Some senators are turned off by the steep cuts to Medicaid in the bill. Yesterday, the Congressional Budget Office issued a new report that said projected Medicaid spending under the Senate Republican bill will decrease by 35% after two decades. Arkansas is one of the states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and that expansion covers more than 330,000 people. Asa Hutchinson is the Republican governor of Arkansas. He joins us now. Governor, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Well, what do you think at this point of the Senate's proposed plan to replace the Affordable Care Act?
Well, they've got some work to do. Obviously, we need to change from the status quo. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is not going to be sufficient in the long term. Everybody agrees on that point. The Senate brings some good things to the table. It gives us more flexibility in the states. They have given back to the states really the insurance regulation, which is an important part of the equation. They reduce the burden on the deficit. They have savings. So good things about the Senate bill, but there's some real problems when it comes to the states like Arkansas, that there's a significant cost shift on our health care system back to the states that many states cannot afford it. Arkansas is one of those. And so we took the Medicaid expansion, actually my predecessor did before I became governor. The state took the Medicaid expansion with the commitment of federal participation of 90%. And now they come in and they reduce that participation, which puts the states in a bind that we cannot afford that. We cannot subsidize that kind of exposure and payment. And so it would have a significant impact on reducing the Medicaid coverage for the expanded population. And they do cuts to the traditional Medicaid population that is a concern. So I've made some recommendation that hopefully will be listened to in the Senate that will improve the bill that they are currently considering.
Well, you said in a press conference, I'm a little bit worried that they've really tried to protect the non-expansion states, and they're putting a lot of money into the non-expansion states. This is all about votes there, and that worries me. What do you mean by that, this is all about votes?
Well, I mean, we've seen that before. You look at the special deals on Medicaid for the states. You've got New York, California, other states that all have carved out special payments to the states under the Medicaid program, and that creates some inequities out there. And so now we're in a position that they're obviously trying to get votes to pass the Senate bill, which is understandable. I've been in that process before, but they want to bring in the non-expansion states, and they're covering additional payments for those states that you've got to look at very carefully as to whether the money is being dispersed fairly among all the states. And one of the principles of the governor's is that there should be a solution that does not reward or punish any state based upon whether they took expansion dollars or did not. And so I think that has to be looked at very carefully.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 172,000 people would lose coverage in your state under this bill, 144,000 of those in Medicaid and 27,000 in the individual market. Is that acceptable to you, that there just isn't the federal money to pay for those people to continue to be able to have health insurance?
Well, it's a great concern to me. My goal is to reform the Medicaid system, both in Arkansas and nationally, but to do so in a way that gives the states the flexibility and the ability to control the cost, but also to keep the health care coverage that's so important. And so Arkansas has already initiated significant reforms to save money, to put in work requirements. That is significant reform. And so if you continue to give us the flexibility to do that, then we will help control costs both for the state and the federal government. And so my objective is not to throw people off of the Medicaid expanded rolls or the traditional Medicaid. My objective is to control costs, but to make sure we have the safety net that's important, as well as some reasonable assistance for those that are trying to move up the economic ladder. So our suggestions addresses those. A very simple thing is that right now the block grants that they are suggesting the Senate bill excludes the expanded population. We need to have the ability to manage that population as well and hopefully preserve as much coverage as we can, even though there's cost-saving measures in place.
Well, when you say the goal is to control costs, have you seen any solution so far that, would actually get health care costs to stop going up in general?
Yes. We just give the states more flexibility, and we can control costs. Now, we can't control everything and, reduce the growth completely, but we can reduce the growth of health care expenditures by good management. For example, we set as a goal to save $800 million in savings on our Medicaid budget over 5 years. We're going to meet that goal, and that's something that benefits the federal government. But you've got to give us the tools. You've got to give us the opportunity to manage it and not continue down this path of strict federal controls that eliminate some of the flexibility of the states. You've got to give us the block grant capability for the expanded population. You've got to avoid a massive cost shift back to the states on the traditional Medicaid coverage, because that's something that we can't neglect our elderly population, those assisted living residents. We've got to take care of those, and if you minimize the reimbursement to the states on that, then that's something we have to pick up that makes it more difficult for us to cover the expanded population.
Yeah, about 65% of nursing home residents are on Medicaid. Do you have a sense at this point of how the Senate bill would affect people in your state who are in nursing homes?
Well, they would give us the option or put it into a per capita cap for some of that population, and they are high expense, high need categories that's unpredictable, and the states would wind up absorbing a greater percent of the cost for those residents, and that would be tough on the states. And so we're left with a conundrum of either cutting somewhere else in the programs, raising taxes, which is not going to be acceptable in this environment, or reducing services, and that's not the arena that you want to reduce services for our elderly population. That's who was originally to be served by Medicaid, so it's going to result in further cuts or an abandonment of the coverage under the expanded population to conserve our dollars to cover the most needy. And so there's significant consequences both in cost to the states, but also in our ability to deliver the services and cover those that are currently receiving health care coverage.
Do you feel like your concerns are being listened to in Congress about this health care bill?
I do. We have communicated regularly from the first of the year as a group of governors, and now that it's in the closing days, we're communicating very carefully with our own congressional delegation, and our senators have been very responsive. They've seen my list of requests or recommendations. I've been, you know, some of them are doable and some aren't doable, but they're listening and they're really pushing to try to find the right balance, because the current system that we have has got to be changed.
That's Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. Governor, thank you for joining us.
It's always good to be with you. Thank you.
And later today on All Things Considered, NPR's Susan Davis on the political stakes of passing or not passing some kind of Obamacare repeal and replace bill. Well, as we go to break, we want to say farewell to a great friend of this show and of NPR. Audio engineer Manoli Wetherill has been with NPR for nearly 39 years. Over the last 4 years, she's been making a whole lot of here and now interviews possible from the controls in the NPR New York Bureau. Manoli is retiring and leaving the Big Apple for the Big Easy. Robin and I and the whole staff at Here and Now will miss her, and we wish her all the best.
And an update now on a couple of stories we've been following. People in southern Utah are being allowed back into their homes for the first time in nearly 2 weeks as fire crews continue to contain that wildfire. Evacuation orders were lifted today in the ski town of Bryan Head. More than 92 square miles were burned at the fire's height, 1,500 people forced from the town. In Michigan, officials with the Department of Natural Resources say that DNA samples from two rivers, the St. Joseph and the Kalamazoo, show no signs of the invasive Asian carp. Last week, a live silver carp, a type of Asian carp, was caught in an Illinois waterway about 9 miles from Lake Michigan and beyond an electric barrier that keeps carp from entering the lakes, where they eat up the plankton that other creatures depend on. So they might want to check that barrier. And by the way, it's Aquatic Invasive Species Awareness Week next week in Michigan. Woohoo. So, from trying to get rid of the Asian carp to trying to save the American bald eagle, habitat destruction and the pesticide DDT nearly caused the extinction of that species in the 1960s. In 1972, DDT was banned, and with federal and state protections, the bald eagle population boomed. But now, the American bald eagle is again facing a dangerous threat, lead poisoning from ammunition. Angelica Morrison of Here and Now contributor Great Lakes Today reports.
Meet Kevin Hines. He's a biologist with New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, and today he's getting ready to dissect a bald eagle's body.
Well, sometimes we look at eagles that are in considerably worse postmortem condition than this, and sometimes we get them fairly fresh.
Dead birds like this one are taken to his lab near Albany. There he performs an examination. Today's results show lead bullet fragments inside the bird, along with deer hairs and fibers. The cause of death was lead poisoning. Environmental experts like Hines are seeing a disturbing trend, an increase in lead-related deaths among bald eagles.
And now it's getting worse because the population is growing, so there's more out there to die.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates there are 143,000 bald eagle nesting pairs nationwide. The Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota has been keeping track of the lead problem. Last year, they took in 183 injured bald eagles who were brought to the center for healing and care. Executive Director Julia Ponder says close to 90% of the eagles they take in have lead exposure, and 25 to 30% have lead poisoning.
And I can also tell you that of the 25 to 30% that have lead toxicity, most of those die in our center.
Here in the Great Lakes region, there are more than 3,000 nesting pairs. And while lead poisoning numbers are relatively small, scientists say it's concerning. In 2009, New York State recorded 2 lead-related deaths. Last year, there were 9. Kristen Schuler is a wildlife disease ecologist at Cornell University.
And while it might not be at a rate that is affecting their population, because we're finding that oftentimes it's adult birds, the birds that are now of breeding age, that those are the ones that are getting lead poisoning.
Schuler is working with Hines on the issue. She suggests that lead contamination could contribute to a stunt in population growth of bald eagles.
So you could potentially be having impacts on the population where it's not growing quite as quickly as it would have if you don't see that mortality.
Schuler says eagles feast on the animals that were shot with lead ammunition. They see it as an easy meal, but it's usually a toxic one, with lead fragments lodged inside the carcasses.
So it's not something that the bird necessarily notices while it's eating, but then when it gets into the stomach and the lead is dissolved and taken up into the bloodstream, then it can start to have different neurological problems.
The key to solving the problem, Schuler says, is education and discouraging the use of lead ammunition for big game hunting. Lead shot for waterfowl hunting has already been banned nationwide. But she says traditional lead ammunition is cheaper than the non-lead alternative. The National Shooting Sports Foundation opposes efforts to ban traditional ammo. They cite the lack of scientific data that shows population impacts. But ultimately, there's life at the center of this issue. Every spring, more eagle pairs in the Great Lakes region give birth. Like this family, its large nest is set in a tree on the edge of a farmer's field near Lake Ontario. Inside the nest, a brown eaglet played peekaboo with a group of bird watchers.
Oh, he's up on the edge.
Butt shot.
Oh, my God. Oh, look at him.
About four or five birders watch in awe as the eaglet moves in his nest, waiting for his parents to return with supper. For Here and Now, I'm Angelica Morrison.
And Angelica's story was reported with the help of Jim Lavoulis. So the weekend awaits, and Jeremy and I are going to be blowing this popsicle stand.
We're out of here.
Yeah, we're out of here. I understand that was a phrase that was used in the 1920s to mean, let us leave this soda shop. But anyway, you will be in the good hands of Peter O'Dowd and Lisa Mullins, and we hope you have a wonderful, wonderful 4th of July.
Have a great 4th of July. Always been my favorite holiday. And I'm going to be making my annual 4th of July cake with blueberries and raspberries as the American flag.
You make one too?
Delicious.
Does everyone make one of those? Fabulous. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.